imagine any New Yorker voting for Cruz. And he can't beat Hillary. I'm going to beat Hillary. In fact, you notice her commercials came out there about me. They don't even talk about Cruz.
I can take care of myself. I look forward to running against him if he turns out to be the Republican nominee, if I am the Democratic nominee.
When we win, Trump wins.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09. Today is Monday. It is April 18th, 2016. If you need another reminder, it is tax day. You have until midnight to get those taxes done, if you haven't done them already. I have a little bit of a few stats here to maybe help you through the day, make it a little bit easier for you if you are one of those procrastinators. A couple of things to remember. One will make you really mad. The other will make you really sad. The first, I guess, will make you really sad, but it'll also kind of put things into perspective. You know, there are roughly 77.5 million people in America who do not file an income tax, who did not file an income tax return in 2015. And before you get your smoke out of the collar, those people had no jobs. That's why they didn't file income tax. That's the number of people that were unemployed. They did not file a tax return for whatever reason. The Tax Policy Center says today that that number is probably about 75 million again, could be closer to 80 million. Those are people that had very little income last year or no income at all. Now, here's the part that's going to make you really, really mad. That same Policy Institute and the Government Accounting Office suggests that about two-thirds of all U.S. corporations did not pay any income tax during 2012 alone. 42% of businesses that the GAO defines as large enough to pay taxes did not pay federal taxes. 19.5% of big corporations that posted a profit did not pay taxes. Some of them aren't even located in the U.S. anymore. Some big news happening today, but first let's get your overnight market intel from the WGN market desk. Major Asian stock benchmarks sank today after an effort by major oil-producing nations to develop production cuts failed over the weekend. Oil prices rebound just slightly by midday in Asia after falling by about 7% after Iran stayed away from the weekend meeting altogether. 18 oil-producing nations that had been expected to reach an accord freezing production to subdue or support crude oil prices did not. The dollar slipped against the yen and was flat against the euro. Major stock benchmarks ended Friday with small losses, but were up for the whole week as a whole. The Dow Jones Industrials fell about 29 points. Here's the business day ahead. The first of four reports of the housing market scheduled for release this week comes out today. The National Association of Home Builders will issue its housing market index for April this morning. Also today, PepsiCo will report quarterly financial results before the market open. Netflix also expected to report financial results after, though, the market closes. So also today, the back to this meeting in Qatar, these oil-rich nations gathered there hoping that they could put some sort of cap on prices. They're hoping to get oil above $40 a barrel. Remember, oil was about, it was more than $100 a barrel in mid-2014. A lot of the countries that were dependent on oil, like Saudi Arabia, others, have been having a hard time lately. They were kind of hoping to raise it a little bit. You and I have been enjoying these low prices because of the gas price issue. It's caused gas prices to be low, and it looks like those gas prices will stay low for the summer season. General Motors is getting the first real taste of what its Chevy Bolt is up against, the Tesla brand, after being announced in a big showy display a week or so ago. According to reports, some reports now may have already passed the 400,000 mark of reservations. We don't know for sure. It's just being reported by one website, Electrek. There is an estimate that it's probably close to $350,000. The big unveiling happened with Elon Musk in charge. Well, this is the part where the big red car comes out on stage.
All right. So what do you think?
That's Elon. There's something going around in Detroit. Maybe it's called Tesla Envy. Let's bring in Dale Buss, who is a writer for Forbes magazine. He's written about this today. Dale, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Morning, Steve.
So do you have a number? Do you know how many of these things have been reserved?
I don't. I've seen the same reports you have. And if it's not at 400,000 already, I'm sure it's destined to get there soon. I mean, it reminds me that little counter ring, you know, behind Elon Musk's desk is probably, it's kind of like the nuclear doomsday clock for General Motors and the rest of the industry. That's kind of how they look at it. Because if he really does have, let's say the clock stops or the counter stops at this point, he has 400,000 orders for that car when it comes out in about 18 months or so. You know, his revolution will be complete if that actually happens.
Well,
there's a lot of ground to cover in the meantime.
Yeah, I want to get into the nuts and bolts of this coming up. We have to break here for traffic, but just before we go there, I'm wondering, because put in perspective, you could, how much 400,000 cars, how much that is, because...
Well, that's typically the output of a couple of assembly plants.
Yeah. And these are not scheduled for delivery, correct me if I'm wrong, till 2018.
Right. And Musk has a terrible history of coming through when he says, so whenever the car comes out, if he actually has that many orders, I mean, that's huge. That is truly going to be revolutionary if that happens. But there are a lot of ifs. Mm-hmm. Before we get there, I'm sure we'll talk about that.
We're having a conversation this morning with Dale Buss, who's written about this in Forbes magazine today. You can follow Dale at Dale D. Buss on Twitter, and we will continue our chat about Tesla and the Model 3 coming up.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Oil-rich nations at a summit in the Persian Gulf have failed to reach an agreement on a production freeze. Iran did not attend and vowed to keep pumping crude. The lack of an agreement means oil prices will likely drop again as markets open today. Major U.S. stock benchmarks ended Friday with small losses, but were up for the week. The Dow fell 29 points on Friday to 17,897. The Standard & Poor's 500 lost 2 points Friday. The Nasdaq Composite dipped 7.5. The twin earthquakes that have paralyzed parts of southern Japan are having a ripple effect far beyond the disaster zone. Toyota has suspended output in other areas due to disruption in its parts supplies after quakes struck last Thursday and Saturday, killing at least 42 people. And Southern California-based Sports Chalet has begun closing all its stores and to stop selling merchandise online. Founded in 1959, the sporting goods company has about 50 locations across the West, but hadn't turned a profit in years. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 520. Welcome back to the program. We're talking about Tesla Motors today and the new Model 3 that's been unveiled recently. The number of orders, somewhere between 300 and 400,000. We're on with Forbes writer Dale Buss, who's written about this morning. Dale, I want to play you a clip that we had last week. This is from Steve Dudash. He's a financial advisor with IHT, and this is what he said about Tesla and whether or not you should buy their stock.
Okay.
And he made these comments, by the way, on CNBC.
They cannot produce that number of cars. There's no way they can produce the cars at the price that they're claiming.
So, it kind of goes along with our discussion this morning. Can they pull this off? Is it a shell game? What exactly is going on with Tesla Motors?
Well, indeed, Elon Musk has to prove that he can deliver on cost, on volume, and on time. And he's never really done any of those with the Model S, you know, his first very highly regarded EV. Or the new Model X, his first SUV, both of which typically punch out at around $100,000 or so. And, you know, this is part of why there's like a huge case of what I did call Tesla envy going on in Detroit. It's over the fact that Elon Musk, you know, doesn't deliver, he doesn't play by the rules, and he mocks the entire rest of the industry. So last week, for example, there was a big engineering conference here, the Society of Automotive Engineers, huge annual gathering in Detroit. They had a panel about EVs. It's a two-hour discussion, and according to the Automotive News, nobody mentioned Tesla until 1 hour and 53 minutes in, and they only mentioned Tesla once. So you'd say, well, there's a huge case of denial going on in Detroit. Well, no, it's not really, because there is the Chevrolet Bolt, which is supposed to be delivering essentially the same thing as Tesla, which is, you know, more than 200 miles of all-electric range at about $35,000 before rebates, but it's going to be in a GM package. The thing is, it's supposed to be out within a year, and it probably very much, you know, will be. So, you know, that could rock Elon Musk's world before the Model 3 rocks General Motors' world. It'll be fascinating to watch.
Now, here's the thing that I think of immediately, and I don't mean to be flip, and maybe this is what other people are thinking too, but he landed a rocket on a barge.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's absolutely no doubt that when it comes to, you know, digital wizardry, Elon Musk, you know, has been able to do all sorts of stuff, including, yeah, everything that he's doing with SpaceX. But that is different than mass production of a mainstream consumer commodity, which is something that Detroit and, you know, Tokyo and everybody else has been doing for decades. And whatever you may think of their products, whatever you may think of where they are at technologically and how they have, you know, simply not stepped up to the plate basically with EVs so far, they do know how to make automobiles. And it's just something that Tesla and Musk have not proven that they can do in volume at this point, especially with Model 3 being the price point being $35,000 before rebates. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tesla has made its money on very expensive cars that are done very well. When you get down to a price point that's about a third of a Model S, it's a whole different proposition, and he just simply hasn't proven that he's done it. He may be able to, but he hasn't proven that.
Well, and when you say they make them well, there is even part of the sector that would question that, because amid all of this discussion was the announcement last week of the recall of some of the Tesla 2700 Model X SUVs, and it brings to question, you know, whether they're rushing these things through, what exactly their production is. Obviously, that's a different model, but it does speak to, you know, what kind of pressure they might be under.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, part of the mythology of Model S, well, not mythology, the reality is that it's done at such a high-quality level that Consumer Reports had to break their system for evaluating vehicles last year to come up with a new way of describing how wonderful that vehicle was. But, yes, there are mounting pressures on Tesla for all sorts of reasons, and one of them is cost and timing. And, you know, they've proven that they're mortal when it comes to quality. And, of course, if you recall, before the car came out, there was this huge mocking review in the New York Times of the Model S because it simply ran out of power at one point when the New York Times guy was reviewing it. You know, and Elon Musk, you know, went volcanic and did this huge blog post where he basically took down the New York Times. Just a really interesting chapter in what he was going to ultimately mean to the auto industry.
Well, as I look at the numbers this morning, and pre-trade, obviously, GM is off about 0.5%. Tesla is up about 1%. The markets don't seem to be too excited about either of these companies.
Right. Well, the fact is they're still, I mean, increasingly, Musk is part of the auto industry. So to the extent that, you know, he becomes more like the other automakers, there's less excitement about the stock. And EVs are still really dubious as a mass market proposition. You mentioned in your opening in the show about gasoline prices probably going to be low at least the rest of the summer and probably way beyond. So as a toy, as a $100,000 toy you stick in your garage and take out on weekends to get your friends to envy, Model S is one thing, but as a mass market proposition, neither Bolt nor Model 3, you know, can benefit yet from the proven desire of the typical American consumer for an all-electric vehicle.
So give us a sense, Dale, of when, if we had to put a milepost on this, when will we see a milepost where people who have made these orders start scratching their heads going, wait a second, am I going to get my car?
Well, they've all got to be kind of wondering that. I mean, so far, they've only put down $1,000, and I believe it's refundable. So, you know, it's nice a nice little game, a nice little, you know, thing to put, have an app on your phone saying only 365 days till I get my Model 3. I would say by next year, Musk has got to put down some pretty strong signposts about when to actually expect these vehicles. But, you know, that's just part of the wonder of him. He can get away with saying, well, you know, okay, maybe it'll be another year, but it's really going to be cool when it comes.
Yeah.
And nobody else has ever done that kind of thing in Detroit, and that's why he's such a fascinating figure.
Dale Buss is a writer for Forbes magazine. You can read his latest model on his latest article on the Model 3 and Tesla Envy at Forbes.com. Follow on Twitter at Dale D. Buss. Dale, thanks for being with us this morning.
You bet.
The WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, 538. Welcome back to the program. Experts in law enforcement and in law enforcement have been saying it's just a matter of time, and now it has happened.
BA pilot has reported that a drone hit his BA passenger plane. It was landing at Heathrow Airport. Well, the aircraft touched down safely, but the incident has already resulted in anger, with experts warning their concerns about potential threat in our skies have been ignored for too long.
That's Sky News from yesterday, an airline safety expert telling the network.
Well, fortunately, on this occasion, it appears there was very little damage or no damage, but it could be very serious. These drones have a lithium battery in them, which we know will explode on impact, or can explode on impact. If it goes down an engine, you have the potential for an uncontained engine failure with damage to the aircraft. I mean, pilots are trained to deal with a single engine failure, but clearly something the size of a drone, even a small one, can do a lot of damage.
Let's get the latest on this now. ABC News correspondent Tom Rivers from the Foreign Desk in London this morning. Tom, a pretty scary situation, but as I said in the open there, people have been saying this is just a matter of time until this happens, and now it has.
Exactly. In fact, last year, Steve, out at Stansted, London City, Manchester, in addition to Heathrow, they were very close misses, okay? So you're absolutely right. At some stage, one of these things will be hit, and certainly was the case on Sunday. And as we heard as well, a very light damage. The engineers rolled it in, they inspected it, and they said, look, the damage is very, very minimal. So it continued with its scheduled flights back and forth to Geneva. But again, with these lithium batteries, if it gets in an engine, pilots say they'd like to know what would happen. Would it be destructive in an engine? Would it just pass through? They don't know, but they want some tests done on that one.
This was a pretty big aircraft. It was an Airbus A320, but it had 132 people on board.
Sure.
And, you know, the question is, who would fly their drone purposely into a plane? These are not cheap little devices, and that has to be a question law enforcement's asking.
Exactly. And I guess it's the same people that have these little laser pens that flash them in the cockpits as well. Some pretty, you know, senseless pursuits, if you will, but it is going on. And they would like to strengthen laws right now on the books here in the UK. If you and I put up a drone right in the flight path out at, say, Heathrow, we could be sentenced to 5 years in prison, and they would like to strengthen things. Authorities would say they would like all drones in the country registered, so if your drone or my drone happened to be the one that got close to a plane or impacted the plane, they would somehow know that it was registered to us, so we would kind of be in the frame on that score. So they're looking at different ways to combat this, but boy, there's a heck of a lot of them out there, and it seems like every Christmas, every other kid on the block is getting one of these things.
You know, and then there's the nefarious side of this too, Tom, and that is, you know, somebody who would fly their drone into a plane might be testing out just what we have been talking about, and that is, can I bring down an airliner?
Yeah. Exactly. And an A320, two engines, and if you knock out one, you're in some pretty difficult territory. If you knock out two, end of story. Lights out. So you're absolutely right. It's something else to look at in the whole, if you will, blanket of anti-terrorism kind of provisions here. So it's something else that the authorities have to be concerned about.
This morning I had a little time, and this is not just a problem in the UK. I downloaded from the FAA here in this country, the Federal Aviation Administration, their latest data on near misses and drone incursions, as they've called them. There are, since January, according to the FAA in the United States, there have been 583 of these incidents from airports all across the country. Weren't the people that made these drones supposed to put in some sort of software in the GPS that would tell them, hey, this thing can't fly in a protected zone?
Yeah, you would hope so. In fact, they have the technology. It's called geofencing software that would, in essence, put up like a force field, if you want to think of it in those terms, saying this thing can't get close to harm's way, for instance, at an airport. But a lot of these things, the cheaper ones, go up there, and this software is not there. And, again, that's something else they're looking at, and possible legislative action down the road to incorporate that in every drone, for instance, in this country, so that even if you're close, you cannot get any closer than the authorities want. For instance, Heathrow, London City, Birmingham, Manchester, fill in the blank.
Now, is the Metropolitan Police there handling this investigation? And I don't want to put words into anybody's mouth, but is it possible for one of these drones to carry explosives?
I guess it could be. You know, I don't know what the payload on a small drone would be, but you certainly could. Question is, well, you know, you hear about it all the time, too, in laptops, lithium batteries. They can explode. So that would be a concern if these things are powered by lithium batteries as well. They got into an engine. If they explode, what kind of damage could that incur? We don't know. But you're absolutely right. You get a larger drone, certainly that could carry some pretty nasty material up and put it in harm's way.
I would guess that their investigation now is they're going to try to find this drone and then maybe backtrack it.
They will try. I mean, you know, who knows? It might be in a, tons of little tiny fragments, and you know, they may very well not find out who did this. But boy, can you imagine if it's wow. If it's younger people that did this or somebody else? This is something you don't do. You don't mess with it. But obviously, some people are getting their kicks out of flying these things real close, right? You know, in the flight path, right out by Heathrow. And if landing would probably come in by Terminal 4, coming right across the main road there by Hatton Cross subway station. And, boy, they fly very, very low there, and it is scary indeed.
Tom Rivers, ABC News correspondent with us from London this morning from the Foreign Desk. Thanks for being with us on the Opening Bell.
Take care, Steve.
It's 5:45, and we have some breaking news just into the WGN newsroom via Sky News. Sky News now confirming there's been a migrant ship disaster, if you want to call it that. It's approaching that level. Sky News just reporting that at least several hundred people have been killed in what appears to be a failed crossing from Egypt to Europe. This is a developing story. Sky News just on with it moments ago. They say the death toll could be several hundred people. There have been reports as many as 500 people, 400 to 500 people, may have been killed. We'll continue monitoring that story throughout the morning.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
5:49 on the market desk. Futures are lower, pointing to a lower open on Wall Street later this morning. The Dow futures off 35. NASDAQ S&P futures also lower. Let's get the latest on commodities markets. And here is Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. And on this first trading day of the week, this afternoon at 3 o'clock, a lot of people will be focused on the planting progress report due out at 3 o'clock from the USDA. A lot of planting done over the weekend to the south of us, but also some here in Chicago area and north. We ended last week with a pretty good trading day. The Midwest cash hog market held steady to firm, and CME live cattle futures finished mostly firm. Hogs were higher for the day. And the corn market on Friday at the Board of Trade hit a four-month high on short covering. Soybeans also firm. So all in all, not a bad week to wind up on Friday at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. It's well known that higher incomes are correlated with longer life expectancy, and one could pretty reasonably cite the main reasons for this being that there's less stress. Obviously, if you have a billfold full of money, there are some other issues too. But there is a new research app that says this is really becoming a statistical anomaly. There are a lot more people who are not rich, who are poor, who live in underserved areas, who are not living as long. Let's bring in ABC News correspondent Mark Remillard, who has been covering this story. Mark, what did this research find?
Yeah, what they found was that we've known for some time that there's an association between higher income and a longer life expectancy, but the study really found that there's quite a severe gap, though, as you go up the economic scale. And so what they found was that, for example, if you're a 40-year-old male in the top 1%, you can expect to live to be 87 years old. But your counterpart in the bottom 1% will die before he's 73 on average. So we're talking about a 15-year difference in life expectancy from being at the top and being at the bottom. And it's about 10 years for women, so there's a little difference there between women. But so what this study showed was that not only is there a huge gap in life expectancy based on your income, but what it found, too, is that that gap is widening. So it looked at tax data and death records from the federal government and found that between 2001 and 2014, people in the top 5% could expect to see a gain of 2 to 3 years on their life expectancy versus those at the bottom 5% were relatively flat. They weren't gaining any better outlook on their expectancy. So not only shows the wide gap, but shows that that gap is getting wider.
Is it affordability of healthcare, availability of healthcare? What are the factors that might be to blame here?
Yeah, you would think that that would play such a big role, that that's often what we hear when we, this has been a big issue in the 2016 race, and you would hear, that access to healthcare, improving environmental qualities, these kinds of things would play a big role. But really the research showed that the biggest factor for people was their behaviors, their lifestyle choices. Do they smoke? Do they eat well? Do they exercise? What it found was those at the top, it really didn't matter where you live, your expectations remain pretty much the same, but in the bottom 25%, depending on where you live in the country, could make a big difference on what your life expectancy is. So what they found was areas of like the Rust Belt, Ohio, Michigan, certain parts of these had very low life expectations, and they found higher rates of people who were smoking, eating poorly, not exercising, versus they found that the bottom 25% that live in places like New York or San Francisco, places with highly educated populations, higher incomes, higher level of government programs, had better outlooks, sometimes by as much as about 4.5 years better. So it made a significant difference when you're in the bottom 25% where you live. But it's not as closely linked to whether or not you have Medicare or health care or things like that. It was actually more on what you do with yourself.
There are some that would say that, you know, if you have money, you're probably less stressed about earning money. Did stress, do you think, have a role in this, did researchers say?
You know, I didn't see whether or not it specifically spoke about stress specifically and where that would fall. That may fall into an environmental factor rather than an internal factor on you, whether or not you're smoking or eating and how you're exercising. That would be maybe something more internal in how your lifestyle is rather than looking at environmental things about the cost of living. But interestingly enough, the people who were in the bottom 25% but live in expensive areas like New York, San Francisco, did better than those living in some of these more affordable areas, or people where you could consider it more affordable, Gary, Indiana, Michigan, Detroit, these places, compared to New York and San Francisco, where you would imagine there'd be a greater stress on money because things are so expensive. They actually had a much better outlook if you were not in the top, even the top 75%. You're in the bottom 25%. You had a better outlook in those places.
This is a huge sample size, 1.4 billion Americans over this long period of time. What are the researchers going to do with this, and where might their study head next?
Well, it'll continue to, this really bolsters the look at what the broader effect of income inequality. So, you know, we hear a lot about this in this 2016 race from Donald Trump on the Republican side to Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. It's been an issue for both parties. This talk about the disappearing middle class and the concerns that might have. Now, I think the first look is really on the pocketbook. If the middle class isn't there, then the breadbasket of America is not spending, these kinds of things, and that economic concern. But what this really shows is this has an impact on people's health and their ability to enjoy their lifetimes and expand their lifetimes. And so I think they'll start looking at this possibly with a different lens when we talk about income inequality, that it's not just about being able to afford things. It's the fact that you might just not even live as long as a counterpart who makes more money than you.
All right, ABC News correspondent Mark Remillard with us from New York this morning on this survey between income and health. That's the opening bell for this Monday. Pay your taxes. Hopefully you'll get to the post office before midnight. The Steve Cochran Show is coming up next. Lots of ground to cover there. We'll see you bright and early tomorrow morning for another edition of the opening bell. The show is produced by Mary Sandberg, our engineer this morning, Ben Cortez. Production help from Bennett Wake Knight. Thanks for listening, and see you tomorrow. I'm Steve Krasanich. Have a great day.